swords.
It's surely illegal.
Dads with swords. Dads with swords.
It just shouldn't happen.
Dads with swords.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Dads with Swords. I'm Brant.
I'm Krista.
I'm Brian.
And this is episode 9. And yeah.
Nine, ten?
I believe so.
It's nine.
Are you sure it's nine?
It's nine.
Okay. Yeah, we just posted it.
Yeah, usually we record an episode in advance, so we are ready to post, but we kind of got sidetracked.
It's thrown us off.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I went back to work a couple of weeks ago, so things are getting hectic.
Hectic and very time crunchy. Like, all time is just being mashed together.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So we're kind of continuing with the trend of, I'm not going to say vague subjects, but definitely broad stroke subjects.
Open subjects.
Yeah, open. Not necessarily tied down to any one thing. And we're going to talk this week about chivalry, I guess, in the broadest sense of the term. You know, a code of conduct, ethical.
Yeah.
Strong. So, yeah. How has this played into your guys' lives?
I hear this term a lot. I've been hearing it since I was a wee-in, what it means to be a chival person, or
chivalrous,
I guess. And it's something like, you know, you're told, like, you should, as a woman, you should look for a man who is chivalrous and displays quality of chivalry. And what they're really saying is he should open the door for you. And he should just be nice to you and court you. And I, like, that's all nice and stuff, but it's I find it's a term that doesn't really apply to at least my own personal modern worlds that I live in, where it's not something I really expect in a lot of people. And maybe it's because I don't come across it a lot that I just don't expect it. And when it comes around, it's kind of surprising.
It's a welcome surprise.
It's a welcome surprise, but sometimes it can come off a little dated.
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, I'm a man and you're a woman, and therefore I have to protect you with my muscles and my opening of the doors. Because heaven forbid you ever touch a door with your little fingers.
You've known me for a long time, be honest. When you first met me, was I a little bit like that?
When I first met you, you were a 14-year-old baby, and I was also a 14-year-old baby, so...
You're a baby.
You know what? Thinking, yes, you were a little bit like that, and I think it was very sweet. You definitely courted me as a 14-year-old baby.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not ashamed to admit it, at least not now. I learned a lot of my, like, social skills at that age from fantasy novels, so I was pretty sure I knew how to woo a lady.
Yeah, woo a lady.
Was it pretty much white knighting, or the classic internet trope, m'lady now, back in the day?
Cringe.
Yeah, a little bit.
I was totally the same way.
Lots of flowers, like, unexpected flowers, and the unexpected gestures, like, big romantic gestures, and, like, you know, playing the long game in the romantic, courtly sense, which, like, I appreciate it, man. You know, I went into high school thinking, like, man, I'm gonna be weird and alone forever. And then now we're just weird and alone together.
Yeah.
Together forever.
Yeah. Exactly.
But I mean, like, now, I mean, as a married woman, seeing it outside of our relationship with other people, I think that there's lots of chivalrous behaviors that people have that are just ingrained, and they might not think about it, because just being a decent person is just programmed into
our
brains.
Chivalry in the modern sense is just, you know, be polite. And if we're going to be stereotypical, we're Canadian, so we've got that just locked down permanently.
That's right. I'm sorry.
No.
Don't apologize.
Yeah, I'm sorry if we offend anybody. Sorry.
Sorry
for that.
Sorry.
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 Yeah, chivalry definitely, like, its roots has more of a sort of an oath-bound duty, whether it's to God or country, or, well, I guess back in the day it would be to your liege or to your lord, to the church or to your God, and then to women. And
yes,
that's definitely where the modern sense of being a chivalrous person, or, you know, it's really tough because it does get confused with, I would say, gallantry. Gallantry is more the modern, you know, upper crust societal expectations that, you know, you're supposed to act a certain way.
Yes.
But I was definitely raised as a kid, like, you know, just to be nice. And that meant holding the door open for people,
mm-hmm.
regardless of gender, regardless of age. It's just, oh, you're coming through the same door as me. I'll just wait 2 whole seconds and I'll keep the door open for you.
I think part of being chivalrous is recognizing that you have a strength that not everyone might have, where you need to, like, you know, use those strengths to protect people and be courteous to people whenever you can.
Yeah, it definitely plays into the historical usage of it, where you swore an oath, essentially, as a knight, to uphold and protect the weak.
Yeah.
And rise above, or rise them above, you know, and, I guess in a lot of ways, it's kind of like modern-day Sikhism.
Yeah.
Like, they're a lot of the same tenets, you know, especially protecting the weak, or protecting the unfortunate, so...
I guess it can also be applied to, like, military service, Brian. Did you have to swear any kind of oaths that...
Oh, yeah. You were there.
I forget.
I had to do a public oath swearing thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, they invited families and we all stood in a room and had to stand up and swear oaths. Yes. Yeah.
I remember now because we went to the pub after.
Yeah.
And that's very much swearing an oath, nationalistic oath.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that you're going to defend your homeland.
Yeah. And, I mean, you could probably argue that that was what some of those old knightly oaths were too. You know, was it defend the weak always, or is it defend the weak who are technically your subjects and you might need them to fight for you later, so make sure that they're okay?
Is that like in the oaths?
Yeah, they were long oaths, lots of ums and ahs and explanations and negotiation. No, I don't know, that's always a tough thing in history too, because we might have some, you know, small third-hand accounts of these, you know, types of oaths and codes of chivalry, but there's no real way to know how well they were being followed, how serious people took them. You know, you've got George R. R. Martin's take on sort of pseudo-history, which is that nobody really seems to care about oaths. You know, they matter when they're convenient and no other time. And I know it's fantasy, but it's still kind of a take on history because he's been inspired so much by historical events.
Definitely rooted. And reading up on it, it definitely seems like the idea of chivalry is a romantic one in that it was kind of invented by the romantic writers.
Right.
Writing, you know, the stories of Sir Galahad and, you know, Roland and all these epic stories of perfect knights who, you know, would defend the weak or would defend the honor of their maiden. How much that was contemporary, like people contemporary in the time trying to strive to be that perfect someone.
Right.
Trying to think of a modern day equivalent, but it would be like somebody trying to be like Ned Stark or trying to be like Captain America or Superman.
Yeah. You know,
trying to be like this mythical figure, but still exemplifies good qualities. Very much the White Knight. Or in this case, you could be more like Batman, be like the Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's almost like in the modern day, to be like that, you are going against the grain. To go out of your way to be nice to someone or to go out of your way to protect people who are weaker than you, you have to go against your grain and against, like, your programming of keep your head down, eyes to the ground. Yeah.
I think the neatest or the most interesting thing about the idea of chivalry is that when you look at it through history, every generation or every era has had their idea of chivalry, and the idea has almost always universally been that chivalry is dead now.
Yeah.
And it used to be everyone was so chivalrous and everyone behaved with such honor. You know, I think we all grew up hearing about a time when, you know, a deal was sealed with a handshake and you didn't need all this legal documentation and a man was as good as his word.
And you always took your hat off in the presence of a woman, especially in a confined area.
It's almost like the concept of chivalry in some cases is just this weird,
it's whatever,
nostalgic.
2 generations ago. Yeah. Oh, it definitely is. I'm sure you had people in the 60s, you know, going on about, you know, Civil War era gentlemen, you know, all that gallantry of the, you know, Lost Cause South.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Then you have those people, you know, back in the 1800s, and they're thinking like, oh, you know, things were back in the knightly ages, you know, where a gentleman was sworn to uphold everything. So they're thinking of that two generations ago.
Yeah.
And then you have those people in medieval times who are looking back to Roman sources, being like, well, these proper gentlemen in the Senate, and this is how the things were, and this is how we should strive to that ideal. It's always this romantic idea of be more like the ideal person in the past. Things were simpler then. Things were so much better.
I wonder if that actually is working to help us grow a sense of honor that will actually suit a species. I don't know if it's true. I don't have any experience in that field of study. But it would be kind of depressing to know that we've, you know, come so far and not come any close to, you know, behaving in an admirable manner. You know, if we can't behave in a way that makes us, as a species, you know, proud of one another, that's kind of crummy.
It's almost as if these behaviors are not natural.
Yeah, maybe that's why they have to be codified to remind you, like, these are the natural impulses you're really supposed to ignore.
Yeah.
They don't work anymore.
Yeah.
It's something, like, it must be something that's bred into people. Yeah. That separates, you know, if we look back in the medieval times, the common folk from the royalty. And,
yeah.
The knights and people of power.
So I've got a cool example of, I guess, sort of like a chivalric code. This is a list of virtues that's actually found in the manuscript of the fencing master that Brant and I study through Ironwood, Johannes Lichtenauer. So, yeah. This comes from a blog, talhofer.wordpress.com, and I'll make sure that I put a link somewhere so that people can go and check this whole article out. But he lists these five cardinal virtues, or maybe there's six, but these cardinal virtues that appear in Lichtenauer's treatise. So the first one being modesty, and I think that we can agree that modesty is not necessarily a natural trait for most people.
It is a very good one to have, though.
Yeah.
Especially when you're coming from a training perspective. Like, I try to approach each class as I know very little, if not nothing, and just try to learn as much as possible.
But it's tough because, you know, there's a, you know, ingrained biological need to be like, I gotta be better than somebody. I gotta prove I'm the one.
Well, yeah. I feel like I'm gonna interrupt here. And
of course you are. Here we go.
I feel like it's hard to talk yourself up. I feel like that, you know, the opposite side is looked down upon too.
Right. So maybe modesty is something that just kind of comes natural to some people. And
maybe, yeah. Like, yeah. Like to be like modest of like, oh, like I'm okay at something instead of being I'm the best. I'm number one.
Yeah.
And everyone else is a loser.
It's definitely tied to self-esteem.
Here's the interesting part in these knightly virtues, though, is that you have modesty, and you have that idea that it's tied to self-esteem. If you have really high self-esteem, it's sometimes harder to be modest.
So you just have to think about
it a bit more. But the next virtue is braveness. And I've seen this written in other translations as valor,
right.
You know, courage. And that's almost the opposite of humility in a lot of ways, or of modesty in a lot of ways. Because if you're, you know, going to be brave and courageous, especially in a knightly sense of going into battle, you kind of have to have a degree of confidence in yourself.
Yeah.
That's, like, applying to the modern world, that's, you know, stepping in to a confrontation.
Yeah, totally.
And knowing that you can handle it, that it's right to do so, and that would be wrong to turn aside. Like, you know, someone was, you know, kicking the crap out of someone else on the street. Most people were all trained to just walk along, so you have to be brave and know that, you know, your choice isn't going to end up with you dead on the street.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think valor is probably just as relevant in the modern world. It takes a lot of different forms. You don't have to worry about jumping on your horse and
charging into battle. A lot of these tenets, valor especially, I'm sure we're going to get into similar ones as well.
Yeah.
But when you think of a occupation or a vocation nowadays in modern times that almost unequivocally holds this esteem of respect and you know, people really look up to them, you're looking at public service workers, like first responders, police, maybe not with the things that have happened recently in certain places, but definitely like fire brigades, You know, people who are the first into a burning building, they're literally throwing their own safety aside because they have a duty to save us all.
Yeah.
And that's extremely admirable.
Yeah, and so, valorous.
And very, very valorous.
Yeah. So the next one is, I think this is one that a lot of people in the modern world, and I'll even lump myself into this, although I'm very clearly working on it in studying martial arts, is celerity. I think that's how you say it. Celerity, yep. Maybe. Yeah. So it's an archaic word, but it basically means like a swiftness of movement. So the ability to move very quickly, very decisively, I would say as well, is really important in martial arts.
I think they're not so much talking about speed and dexterity, but more so being a man of action.
Yeah. And I think that that's really lost a lot in our current era, just because most of our lives don't really call for it. I mean, like, some of us, again, myself included, I can move a mouse fairly quickly, but...
I mean, I can move really quickly if Caleb is falling off something. I can be right there, like that. Or if he's grabbing something.
Parental reflexes.
Yeah, that's just... But that does come naturally.
I think so. Decision making and decisiveness is definitely kind of the intention there.
Yeah,
and you know, some of us who are in that position, you know, that's like management positions, etc. Like myself, it's a little more so tied into ambition. But like, the less responsibility I have, the more I can just focus on the task at hand,
and
the nose of the grindstone,
right?
The happier I am, and to have the paralysis of, you know, commanding people or having some sort of choice on a daily basis,
right?
To me, that's like, I want to steer my ship in the opposite direction.
But it's good that you still get to sort of experience that through martial arts, and that's what's neat about these virtues, is you can see how they really quickly apply to a martial capacity as well. You know, it's important to be humble in a martial environment, because you have to remember there's always the chance the other guy's just better than you.
And you have to respect the fact that we're all wielding weapons and throwing them at each other's heads. So
yeah, there's always the chance that, you know, that's the last time you stand up against someone, which that, you know, brings in braveness or valor. You have to be brave enough to just say, yep, I might die, but I'm going to go and do this. Or in our sense, you know, there's not a huge risk of death, but just that I'm going to put myself in a situation where I might get bruises. I'm going to definitely have a sword swinging at my face, and it's, you know, it's not pleasant to get hit and get grappled and things like that. And you have to go in just allowing that it's going to happen. But then swiftness of movement and that decisiveness as well. I mean, yeah, you have to move your sword quickly. It has to get from point A to point B really fast. But you also have to say, okay, I see this coming and I respond with this in like a split second. Not even conscious thought. It has to be subconscious muscle memory. Just snap.
Yeah.
Applying that to the modern world, you know, we have the luxury of having so many choices laid out in front of us, and that is daunting.
Yeah, it breeds some indecision for sure.
I deal with that every day at work, of just, I can see the, like, you know, people's eyes just going glassy, and you can hear the gears just, like, getting more wound up, and then it's, you know...
You get that, what is it called, FOMO? Fear of missing out?
Yeah, the fear of missing out. And
it's like, oh, if I decide to buy an Android phone, am I going to be missing out on all the, like, awesome iMessage conversations with my friends that are just going to dry up now?
Or, like, the not being prepared for, you know, if something were to happen. Like, a lot of people just don't know what to do if something breaks. And instead of, you know, thinking about your choices or really... like, knowing right away what your choices are, they just come in angry.
Yeah.
It's like, fix this! Make this better!
I've definitely found that practicing martial arts, like, the more involved I am in martial arts at any given time, the better I am at just making decisions.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, the more I'm, you know, falling away from it, you know, if it's just a busy time and I can't get out and practice as much, I get right back to that indecisive nature. So then the next one, man, again, this is a really cool list because it keeps saying, like, this thing and then kind of the opposite of it, because the next one is cautiousness. It's like, you got to be quick and decisive, but you also have to be pretty careful. Yeah. You don't want to do anything, you know, too extreme.
Yeah.
And cautiousness is a neat one that I think is the reason, or at least one of the reasons, that you see a lot of older, very successful, very accomplished fighters in the fencing world. than you do in a lot of other sort of martial arts and martial sports.
Yeah.
Because you have to really learn caution in fencing.
Right.
You know, you see a lot in MMA and in boxing that there are some people who can just take a lot of abuse. You know, they might be really technically good as well, and they're very fast, you know, because they're young and they're strong. But they're really good at just shrugging off those hits that come in. And that's always something that gradually diminishes with age. Whereas I think the ability to be cautious, I mean, when I started in the SCA at like age 18, I thought nothing of a double hit. I didn't care. I kind of liked getting smacked in the head. It was funny. Or like, it was funny to like think, oh, I would have just lost my arm in that fight, but I killed the other guy, so I win, right? Ha ha ha. And now I'm 30 and I'm going, no, I don't. Even that thought experiment is uncomfortable for me now.
Yeah, there was a good, I remember one of the articles I read, I believe it was David Packer's Box Wrestle Fence blog.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where he described himself looking in the mirror. Of course, this is all paraphrasing, but looking at yourself in the mirror and you're seeing all your bruises from the night before, almost like Fight Club.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of going and you're counting like, oh, this one here in the ribs and this one here. And then just the realization that like, oh, that's, I'm dead. That's right through my kidney, or that's right through my liver. That's a liver shot. That's a rapier through the liver.
Yeah.
And like, oh, that's another shot. Oh, that's a, I'm dead again because that's right through the lungs, or that's going to sever an artery. And it's like, every time you get a touch, or a touch upon you, rather.
Yeah.
You're dead.
Yeah, almost.
It's kind of like jiu-jitsu, where you tap. Well, you tapped because you're either going to get a limb broken or you're going to get choked out.
Yeah.
And you die.
Yeah, exactly.
So that definitely breeds the humility.
That's,
it's like every time you get tapped in the head with a longsword, you're dead.
Yeah. Yep. Well, that's like a testament to how intelligent and wise you are when you're cautious. You know, you don't. We know a few people in the SCA world that would just run on ahead.
Oh yeah.
Charging the sword above their heads, not protecting their bodies, screaming. So.
Yeah, my household. God bless them, my household trained as a shield wall for wars in the SCA. Primarily in the SCA anyway, and we definitely had a couple of members who were just not suited to life in the shield wall, and we would use them as berserkers. So as the shield wall approached, eventually they would just not want to listen to the, you know, discipline of the shield wall anymore, and they would just charge ahead and cause as much chaos as possible.
They were in the Order of Jenkins.
That's it, the Order of Jenkins. Okay, so next one on this list is cunning. And cunning is another one that I think is really suited to studying fencing into slightly more advanced age.
Right.
You know, the more you learn and the more you see other people fence, the more chances you have to fence against other people, the more you develop that sense of cunning and that sense of knowing what's going to happen next and how you can play around it.
Right. I think Ole Lichtenauer was just peering into the future and describing like a D&D or Pathfinder character. Like,
right.
You need strength, but you also need dexterity.
That's right.
You need intelligence and wisdom.
Not to say that young people don't have these qualities or can't ever because they're young.
But you probably don't, and that's okay. You're not supposed to yet.
Yeah. You're supposed to build character.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. You're supposed to, you know, gain your levels and add skill points.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not to say, like Krista said, it's not to say that young people don't have their own sense of cunning and, you know, their own sneaky abilities up their sleeves. It's just that those people who are young and have cunning are probably going to get older and be more cunning. It's just sort of the way it works. So it's not to say you're not smart, you're not quick-witted. It's just that you're going to get smarter and quicker, probably.
Hopefully. You know, yeah. That's the plan.
If you avoid those traumatic brain injuries. And
yeah. If that's not your plan, change your plan to that plan.
Yeah. And then the next one is prudence.
Mm-hmm.
Prudence is kind of a, I don't know, it seems like a typically, stereotypically German thing to say. Maybe a typically medieval German concept of, you know, you must do the things that are, you know, come necessarily and logically. Whereas there's a great quote at the end of this blog post, again, that I'll link to. You won't find prudence in the plays or lessons. The learning of the art itself is the prudence.
Right.
So it's just that you take the time, you have the discipline to understand that you come and you learn this art because this will protect you and so on and so forth. So maybe that one was a little bit less of a general virtue and more Lichtenauer telling his students to keep coming back to class.
Prudence is one of the four cardinal virtues.
Yeah.
It's prudence, justice, temperance, and courage.
Right.
I think that could be akin to, you know, Coach Taylor telling his football team, you know, say your prayers, keep it in your pants.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the old 15th century version of, you know, stay true to God, stay true to your family.
Yeah.
You know, say your Hail Marys or your Mein Gotts. Prudence, I think, in a modern sensibility, I don't know, I think it would go more towards modesty. Not modesty, but, like, keeping to yourself, not being boastful, not being braggadocious.
Right.
Basically not being an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy for most and hard for a select few, and you just don't associate with those people.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is basically, like, evaluating the risks that you may need to take and deciding, is this a good move? Is this not? And being able to do it like that. Like,
yeah.
Not, you know.
And that just comes with experience. Yeah.
Yeah, it does come. It must come with experience. I mean, a lot of athletes eventually learn, you know, they don't have the luxury of time on their side. Not when you're in a sport of any kind. You don't have time.
Yeah. And especially in, like, martial sports, like martial arts, you see it all the time in, excuse me, in MMA competitors and boxers. You take abuse and your body deteriorates and you go downhill. Like, it's just a thing that happens. And it's not to say that it doesn't happen to fencers, because obviously eventually it does. Just that fencing is a little bit more gentle on the body in some respects. And, again, it requires a lot more of that sort of patience and technique, and everything is lethal. You can't ever afford to shrug off a hit that doesn't work with a sword. So it's just a different art. It requires a different temperament, I think. Not to say that boxing isn't a good temperament to bring into swordsmanship, but...
Well, I think, too, it could also play into... You might start off your martial career or your fencing career, historical fencing.
Yeah.
Being the strong buffalo, you know, being strong in the bind.
Right.
Being very forceful, knowing your position, knowing how to command a strong presence and put them on the back foot. And then as you grow older, you might realize, like, oh, I'm not as strong anymore. So, you know, I got to start being a little bit more wily. And so maybe you play a little looser in the bind. Maybe you let them push you aside because you're going to, you know, you have techniques, and the whole great thing about historical fencing, especially with longsword and stuff, is there's a big bag of tricks and you can use it all.
Absolutely.
So I think as you get older and older, you know, your retinue of these tricks, you just, it's easier to use them.
So I'm going to go out with a wild and crazy theory. I think that's why we have this concept of chivalry that's always shifting to be a, you know, back then they knew what chivalry was, and today we know nothing. I think it's just this weird perspective that happens, that as you get older, you find it slightly easier to embody those concepts that would be considered chivalrous. You've got less, you know, biology and hormones punching at your brain, making you do things that you'll later look back on and be stupid. So then you look back and you see all these kids who are growing up and you think, oh, look at these kids. They're idiots. Chivalry is dead. Not one of them knows respect and, you know, not one of them knows how to be patient and et cetera. And you completely forget that not long ago, you were the exact same way.
Yeah, exactly. You started from the same spot.
Yeah. It just kind of takes time to grow into the code of chivalry that you have, you know, in your head that you're supposed to behave like. It takes you a while to get to your own goal. Because at the end of the day, that's all chivalry is, really. It's the goal that you set in your head of what kind of person you want to be. And
yeah, it's your personal code of conduct, how you want to conduct yourself in day-to-day activities. And a lot of it now, especially in modern terms, it's stuff that you read in, you know, GQ or something.
Right.
Just talking about it, like, this is, you know, five tips for being a more successful negotiator, or
right,
you know, how to command a room or something. Like, it's all these tricks and tips and stuff they want to give you, but it comes down to simple things where if you're not taught it, then you gotta learn from somewhere.
Yeah.
So if you don't have a authoritative figure in your life, like a good father figure, or in this case a matronly figure who teaches you respect, then, you
know, or awesome comic book characters or
cool,
you know, like I said, fantasy novels. Go read The Wheel of Time, and you can probably follow a progression of my own code of honor going through high school as I would read each book and go, yeah, that's right.
Forge your own way now.
Yeah.
But it's simple things like my grandfather teaching me when I was working at his gas station. You know, when you go out to talk to a customer, take your sunglasses off. Look them in the eye. And as somebody who, you know, is very self-conscious and not the most outgoing person, it was really hard to do so. Right. But then it just makes sense because you just, you know, when you can't see somebody's eyes, there's just something untrustworthy about them.
Yeah.
And so it's a simple, very, very simple little, you know, trick. Well, not even a trick, but like a tip. It's just a something that has stuck with me.
Yeah.
I find, like, if these qualities are just not natural in your environment, and you see it elsewhere, like, you get made fun of.
Right.
Like, a lot of people will make fun of, oh, that guy's, like, he's lame, and he doesn't want to, like, hit on all the girls with us, and he must be gay, and all that stuff. Like, no, he's just a decent person, and you were taught that being kind of crappy was acceptable, when it shouldn't be. But again, it goes back to, like, people just turning their backs and not speaking up and saying, hey, kid, you know, don't talk to girls that way, or don't treat old people that way. Like, it's not okay. I mean, we're not going to shoot you for doing it, but just, like, don't do it again. Just saying, like, don't, you know, just stopping the behavior whenever you can. And, like, you know, with Caleb, he's 11 months old. You can't negotiate with a baby. You can't teach them, don't hit me. Don't poke me in the eye. Don't bite me. Yeah, it doesn't matter. But when he gets older, it's going to matter.
Right.
And it's going to be hard. But nothing that is good is easy. Like, if it's hard, it's worth it. And I think that's I think a lot of people just give up on things when they're too hard.
You know? It's really easy to tell, you know, a shitty kid typically comes from shitty parents.
True. Yeah.
You gotta break the cycle.
Yeah.
And it's easy to say that, like, from the outside, like, I'm adopted and I was brought into a very upstanding family who taught me a lot of values, a lot of Christian values.
We're not going to get into religion on this podcast.
No, we won't. I still pull a lot of those values, you know, into my day-to-day life about how to, you know, talk to people, how to treat children, how to treat elderly people, you know, to know that not everyone comes from privilege and not everyone is in the same spot as you, but to just, like, listen to people. For me, I deal with a lot of people that don't want to talk to me because of who I am, because I'm a girl. And I just have to, you know, I can't take it personally. It's just a thing. And I have to understand, like, the people who feel that way about me, they come from a different time and they've been taught certain values. And I can't assume that they're just terrible, terrible people. I just have to assume that they just don't know better.
Well, there's always, like, there's both sides of the extreme, right? Because it's easy to sit and look at people like that and call them dickheads, douchebags, misogynists. And it's also really easy to look at people on the reverse sort of extreme side and be like, oh, you're just stupid white knight, you know, little pansy or whatever. At the end of the day, it's all just people and everyone's only doing the best thing that they can from what they've been taught. Like, there's not a lot of people that go out in the world being like, I'm gonna be an evil person today. I'm gonna be the bad guy that everybody hates.
Yeah,
they, like, those people that go, you see them go out of their way to be just, like, annoying or meddlesome. They're doing what they think is best.
Yeah,
and maybe in their mind, they're, you know, they have virtues and they have values that they are trying to, like, push onto people that they feel that people don't have.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think maybe it is, maybe some of the embodiment of this notion of chivalry is that you sometimes have to have that bravery, have that valor, and have that decisiveness to step up when someone is really not exemplifying what a rational society should consider honorable. You know, when someone's really being cruel to another human being, when someone, you see someone being abusive, when you see bullying happen, there's a, you know, a degree of chivalry involved in stepping up and saying, I'm not gonna stand here and watch this happen to somebody. That doesn't mean you have to, like, run in fist swinging, but you can call the police, like call the appropriate authorities. If it's, you know, just someone calling somebody else's name, sometimes a random bystander stepping in and saying stop doing that and puts them in their place, and that's the end of it.
Or just being there supporting, like if this is a victim, you know, bullying victim situation, just being there to support the victim.
Yeah.
And just saying like, hey, I'm gonna stand with you, and are you okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, just like, how would you apply this to longsword, like, right with what you're studying right now?
I think we use different terminology a lot of the times now, and part of it is because there is a more critical examination of history that's always underway. So there's a realization that those historic codes of chivalry weren't always as ideal and as, you know, followed very strictly. So it's easy to get lost in sort of a woo-woo feeling if you talk too much about chivalry and honor. But, you know, we talk a lot about control, and we definitely talk a lot about respecting, you know, training partners and things like that in class. And I think they're just more modern words for sort of the same idea. One of the things that I do sort of lament in the HEMA community, and I'm sure there are people who disagree with me, and I'd be happy to hear the other side of it, but the way that we run tournaments with, you know, having judges who are calling points and who are, you know, stopping the action, trying to discuss what they saw and, you know, figure out where the point was called. It's not that it's a bad system, but there's a part of me that misses that SCA honor-bound system where even when you want to win really, really, really bad, it's your responsibility and it's incumbent upon you to be honorable and say, nope, you hit me, I lost.
Yeah.
And, you know, accept that. And I think that in some places and in some cases, the HEMA community is missing out on that. Now, I'm sure most of us still have our own personal sense of honor. I mean, we wouldn't be engrossed in the medieval world as much as we are if we didn't have some kind of pining for that.
And I've definitely seen instances in tournament setting where somebody's calling a shot, like, you know, they come in and it's muddy and the judges can't really clarify.
Yeah.
That person will say, no, I didn't feel anything.
Right.
Or rather the other way around.
Yeah.
Like, he totally hit me in the head. It didn't look like it, but he totally grazed me, and they called a point.
Yeah.
And typically what happens is the marshal will make the announcement to the field.
Yeah.
And any bystander, you know, it's usually a round of applause.
Because it should be.
It's a very noble thing to do.
I know the water always got muddied in the SCA because, again, the SCA operates under those rules where, like, you get hit in the arm and you can't use the arm anymore. So the arm goes behind your back. And there's always a debate where there are some people who will say the appropriate and chivalrous thing to do then as the opponent is to put your arm behind your back and fight them on even footing, even though you don't have to. But then you get the flip side of people who will say that it would be very dishonorable for me to do that because I'm saying to my opponent, I can beat you with one arm tied behind my back, and you're not giving them your all. You're not really challenging them.
Right.
So that's an interesting, you know, side for debate there too, is do you let your opponent be disadvantaged when that's just the case, or do you stop? You know, do you maneuver yourself so that the sun is in your opponent's eyes, as some of the manuscripts will directly tell you to do? Or do you maneuver so that the sun is in your eyes, giving yourself a disadvantage to feel more honor? Or do you try to maneuver into a mutual position where you can have a truly equitable duel?
Oh, that could be part of your cunning virtue.
Right?
It's all coming together.
Yeah.
Definitely boils down to whether you want to be more like Sun Tzu or you want to be more like Machiavelli.
Mm-hmm.
Both had interesting ideas on combat and tactics and leadership. One was a little bit more ruthless, let's just say.
Yeah.
One might have employed the whole pocket sand or, you know, some Saturday Sunday morning pro wrestling moves in a duel situation. That might not be... just be less than honorable.
Yeah.
Oh, but they probably look really cool. Very cool.
I want to see a longsword bout that ends in a chair shot.
Sand in the face.
Yeah, exactly. Pocket sand. Or the green mist.
You guys should actually, like, you know, at the end of your class, just, like, have some
no holds barred
magic sand in there and just sand each other, see what Robert says.
Just have a completely rehearsed, match.
Yeah.
We'll go over on it. We'll never break kayfabe.
Well, I think all I've got to say.
We're getting pretty restless, so
yeah,
that's probably a good spot. So yeah, I think it definitely boils down to it's really just, it's a personal code of ethics.
Yeah.
Or, you know, how you conduct yourself on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, whether it's firm handshakes and you're always giving your word and learning how to say no, never double booking yourself. I think it just comes down to being honest with people.
Yeah.
And as somebody who used to lie a lot, I never lie now, and it feels so fucking good.
Yeah, being honest without being hurtful and mean, you know,
like, it's a real weight on the shoulders, yeah. Rather, to know that, like, I don't have to, there's no sneaking about, there's no, you know, yeah. Anything. It's like,
don't have to remember which lie I told which person.
Or to know, like, when your answer is no, that it's the other person's, you know, response that they're not controlling if they have a freak out about it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, saying, it's not you,
I can't go out tonight because I have to work tomorrow, and then they turn around and say, you're a bad friend. It's like, well, no, I'm not. I'm just a person who wants to go to sleep.
Yeah.
And you just need to, you know, process that disappointment.
Personal code of ethics. Don't follow other people's needs for you to cater to their world.
Yeah. But also, you know, understand that you may have power and skills that others don't have, and not to abuse it.
Krista, we agreed not to talk about our powers.
Oh, shit. You know, not to abuse your dominance over people, if you have it, if you feel like you have it, not to abuse, you know, also, like, not to abuse your weaknesses, saying, like, oh, you can't do that because I'm a girl, or you can't do that because I'm blank. Like, you know, just don't be an opportunist in the nasty sense. Be an opportunist in the chivalrous sense. Yeah.
Very clear.
Take advantage.
Super clear.
Take advantage of the opportunities to show that you're a good person.
Yeah.
Right?
Don't do what Donnie Jones does.
All right. We're getting silly, so this is it. Good night, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.